for the sake of recording, again, this is the 11th lesson on marriage, divorce, and remarriage. We're in the section on the marriage and the bonds. And what we're looking at tonight is this question of not under bondage, because many have seen in 1 Corinthians 7 this phrase, not under bondage, as an excuse to remarry if an unbelieving spouse should leave. And what we'll see through the study of our scriptures is whether that is true or whether that's a false allegation. What we've already seen as we've been looking at apostolic teaching and application, we saw Paul's example of death to law, and we saw his exhortation to sobriety. Both of those in Romans 7 and 1 Corinthians 7, we just kind of touched on the subject in 1 Corinthians 7. What we learned is about this question of marriage or bond, that they're not the same. If it's the first marriage for both people, they then are married and bound. They have both the relationship, the marriage, and they have the covenant with God that binds them together, if you will. That's the bond there. They are bound. And it involves obligations both to God and to one another. Then we have another situation you could be in, according to Romans 7 and 1 Corinthians 7, where there is a person who's widowed, who is unmarried and unbound. And that's another natural situation. Then there is the situation of adultery, where there's a marriage to a second spouse while the first is still living. There's a marriage to one, but the bond is with the other. The obligation and the covenant with God is to the first one. And then there is the marriage of the second spouse after the death of the first, in which case there is another marriage and bond, or married and bound by God to a second spouse. So that's the general teaching on the marriage and the bond. We also looked at this question, who can marry? Who has a scriptural right? Someone who's never been married obviously can marry. God expected that to happen. Someone whose mate has died, we saw that really in the marriage and the bond. The death certainly severs that covenant that you have with that person with God, because the person's not around anymore. Someone who divorces a mate for fornication, we looked extensively at that. And then someone who's reconciling. We've seen all of those situations for people who can remarry, or who can marry, who has a right to marry. Then we also saw who cannot marry, who has no scriptural right. Anyone who has ever been put away, doesn't matter the reason, if you were put away by your spouse, you cannot marry according to the scriptures. And then if you put away someone, but it wasn't for the cause of sexual immorality, for fornication, you put them away just because, for whatever reason. And in both of those cases, the reason is the end result is going to be adultery. There's going to be a marriage to someone that you're not bound to, and that end result is adultery. Then last week, we looked into the details of what is sexual immorality and adultery to see the difference between those two important themes and phrases in the Bible. Sexual immorality is also called fornication. We saw the two Greek words and studied those. And it's a very broad definition. It includes any illicit or unlawful sexual acts, including adultery. But fornication and immorality is the broader term. It typically describes illicit or unlawful sex of the unmarried. We looked at 1 Corinthians 6 last time to understand that. Let's look at Hebrews 13 for another verse that gives us that same indication. Hebrews 13, verse 4. Marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled. But fornicators and adulterers God will judge. Here we have this juxtaposition again of marriage and then things that are outside the marriage bond. Fornication, typically dealing with unmarried people. Adultery, obviously involving at least one married person. Obviously also, though, sexual immorality, since it does include adultery, can describe unlawful sex with a bound person, one who's bound to another. And sexual immorality is the only reason that Jesus has given that allows for divorce. That's the only reason that you could put someone away for that reason, then you could contract another marriage. Adultery, on the other hand, is a very narrow phrase. It comes from these four different Greek words. They're all very similar, have the same root. And it describes only unlawful sex with someone who's bound to another person. That's why it's important that it's in this context of the marriage and the bond that we understand what adultery is. It's illicit sexual relations with someone who is bound presently to another person. It comes from the Latin word adulterare, in English it does anyway, which is a turning toward another, is the idea here, and it's a verb. And then it's always sexual immorality and not vice versa. We looked at this kind of pie chart last time, showing that adultery is just a section of all that is involved in sexual immorality. adultery is only a smaller part. The reason we went through understanding all that is because of this issue that's come up in Matthew 5, of where Jesus said that if a man looks at a woman to lust for her, he's committed adultery with her in his heart. And he uses the word adultery, but that word adultery is not the same as sexual immorality. That lust, that is a figurative kind of adultery. He's fantasizing about adultery, but it is not truly sexual immorality, and we looked at why that's true. The difference between what is sexual immorality and adultery is the difference between the body and the mind in this case. And for it to be sexual immorality, according to 1 Corinthians 6, it is a sexual sin against your own body. It's actions versus the thoughts. Now, certainly the lust is sinful and must be repented of. But the adultery here mentioned in Matthew 5:28 is merely figurative. It is not sexual immorality. It's not grounds for divorce. Therefore, flirting, pornography, internet affairs, and things of that nature are not grounds for divorce, even though Jesus said figuratively those are adultery. What's grounds for divorce is the actual act of immorality, sexual immorality. Having seen all that, today we're going to continue to look at some of these questions and consequences of marriage and the bond. Specifically, does not under bondage, from 1 Corinthians 7, verse 15, does that mean free to marry? Boy, it sure looks like it does. As we see that phrase, and we're talking about married or bound, someone who is not under bondage, does that necessarily mean then they're not bound, therefore, would they be free to marry? Is this phrase in 1 Corinthians 7 another exception? We've seen that you can remarry when your spouse has died. That's what Romans 7 really talks about, the idea that if the former spouse has died, she's not considered an adulteress, even if she contracts another marriage. You can remarry if your spouse commits fornication. That is implied in Matthew 19, because the one who divorces and marries another when it wasn't for sexual immorality commits adultery. But the implication is, if you marry when it is for sexual immorality, you don't commit adultery when you marry again. But is it possible that 1 Corinthians 7 then is opening up a third exception? Remarriage in the case of an unbelieving spouse, a non-Christian, a pagan, should depart from the believing party in the marriage. Does this allow for a remarriage? That is a very hotly debated topic, and it's a hotly defended idea in many, many denominations. Almost all denominations will defend that if you're married to someone from a different denomination even, and they decide to go away, that you can divorce them and go on with your life and marry someone else because of this section here. They're called unbelievers. So let's look at these verses, at least in 1 Corinthians 7, verses 10 through 16, and then we'll talk a bit about the context and the details in these verses. Who'll read for us 1 Corinthians 7, verses 10 to 16? Bob, you got that part?
Now to the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord. A wife is not to depart from her husband. But even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. And a husband is not to divorce his wife. But to the rest I, not the Lord, say, if any brother has a wife who does not believe and she is willing to live with him, let him not divorce her. And a woman who has a husband who does not believe, if he is willing to live with her, let her not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Otherwise your children would be unclean. But now they are holy. But if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. For how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife?
All right, those are the verses that are in controversy here. In order for us to answer this question properly, whether or not this section is offering up another exception, it is super important that we understand the general context and the specific context. We've seen that as important in every bit of this that we've studied so far. What happens is people pull verses like these out of context and say that they mean something that the context doesn't uphold. And when we do that, we're really making up doctrines. We have to keep things in their context. Of course, the general context of this marriage statement, or really any statement on marriage, is God's universal marriage law. That's why we began there way back when we first started this study. When we know the basis for what God says is marriage, it helps us understand when people make up doctrines in other places in the Bible where the whole law is not laid down. Genesis 2:24, we've studied that several times. That is the law that God established at creation for all people. What most people will do when they get into this section here is say that these laws don't apply to all people. That these laws are specifically written, and they'll try to break down sections here and say for whom they're written. Some just for believers. Some just for a believer married to a non-believer, and then some for two non-believers. In fact, they'll say the laws don't apply at all to two non-believers, which is ludicrous. The concept that Christ has no dominion over non-believers. And when he says all authority was given to him in heaven and earth, there are other verses that prove that whether or not people are willing to admit his authority, one day every knee will bow and every tongue will confess he does have authority. His law is for all people. It's interesting that in Matthew 19, another section that we studied greatly, as the Pharisees brought controversy over this law because of their practice of divorce for any reason, Jesus upheld the creation law above their Jewish law, above the law that God had put in for their specific nation. He said, this is what came from the beginning. What you're trying to bring in is a law that was given to you as you came out as a covenant nation, but this is what God said from the beginning. And the only reason that Jewish law even was about is because you were already in sin, and God was regulating so it wouldn't get worse. So Jesus upheld Matthew 19, Genesis 2, above Jewish law and Jewish tradition. And what's interesting, if you look at the language here in 1 Corinthians 7, especially verses 10 to 13, there's nothing new in those verses. Don't depart. Don't divorce. If you're married, do not divorce. If you do divorce, either stay as you are or be reconciled. In fact, we looked at those verses before when we were talking about the possibility of remarriage. That's the only option given. It's not saying, I command you to leave and stay out there on your own. I'm authorizing separation. That's not at all the question. If it does happen, however, the only thing that can happen is you stay by yourself or you come back to the one you left. So 1 Corinthians 7, verses 10 to 13 at least, puts this study in the context of God's universal marriage law because it basically rests on it. As Paul is laying down the arguments, he's resting on what God's universal law states. So, as we said before, all marital issues must be examined in the context of God's universal marriage law. To take it out of that context, you're just making up doctrine. God put everything within his realm of law. Now, having said that, what is the specific context? This is where we're going to spend most of our time this evening and perhaps some in our next study as well. What are the specific contexts around this particular issue that comes up? Well, there are several issues that come up, really. The first of those, Paul is talking in the first verse of chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians concerning the things of which you wrote to me. Let's have a look at what he means here. Those things of which you wrote to me, he's responding to questions that they must have sent to him or had someone take to him. It's the overarching context for the whole chapter. Whole chapter 7, he begins by saying, let me respond to some things you asked about. He does it a couple of other times in the book as well. Verse 8, chapter 8, now concerning things offered to idols. Obviously they had written to him about that. And so he's responding to these questions, but in chapter 7, certainly, everything that's in this context, he's dealing with questions he's responding to. The problem is we don't know what the questions were. Not exactly. We can tell what they must have been in some instances because of the response that comes, and in some instances he says, when you ask me about this, here's the answer. But it's hard to know exactly what they wrote. But here are some things we can know. What they wrote about involved moral issues of sexuality and marriage. Let's remember that these are people growing up in a Greek culture, in a Stoic culture, where they're told to throw off anything bodily. The body is, there's two main schools of thought, but the body is seen as just a cage for the soul. One school of thought is, if the body's just a cage for the soul, the body can do whatever it wants, and it's not going to affect the soul. So go out and eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die. That's one side of philosophy. The other side was, we better keep this body as clean as possible so we don't damage the soul. It was a reaction to the one. And so what is believed is happening here is that these people came along, they become Christians now, and they see in some way that sexuality is wrong, is evil, because it involves the body. So Paul is responding, and he says in verse 1, for example, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. You're right on that in general. But there are certain ways in which sexual relations in themselves are not immoral. There's nothing wrong with it. God created men and women, and he created the means for procreation. So the question that comes really is, are sexual relations immoral? And he answers that in the first 7 verses or so. He talks about that they're not immoral, but that there is a proper outlet for sexual relations. It's when the husband has a wife and the wife has a husband. The authority of the body belongs to each other, and they should not deprive each other of that. Seems even that perhaps married Christians who had been converted later, who had been converted to Christianity after their marriages, were starting to separate themselves. And this idea even that maybe they should just divorce so they could devote more time to being holy. And Paul thwarts that idea. He says, not at all. Don't deprive yourselves, because then Satan will take advantage from your weakness. So sexual relations are not immoral. They just have to be within the right context. Well, then, from that comes the next question, the next set of ideas in verses 10 through 24, really. Would a marriage, then, between a Christian and an unbeliever be immoral? Because I am holy, and I understand what God's law says, but here's a person who's a pagan. This person may even be offering themselves at the pagan temple. And then, wouldn't that make me a partaker of the pagan temple if I am a partaker of them as well? That's a tough question. And so Paul has to answer that. And he's saying, you need to give to the husband and to the wife. You need to render what's due. These marriages are not immoral. And then verses 25 and following, Paul couches some of this into a present context of a present conflict or present difficulties. But the question is, should I not let my daughter then marry? We're already married. We're already in the situation, so we can't get out of it. You're saying, we understand God says don't divorce. But isn't it better just to keep our daughters and our sons from ever marrying? Then they won't have to worry about this stuff. Paul says it'd be great if they can do it. Paul said, I was blessed with being able to do it. If they can do it, great. But you're not sinning if you allow them to. Marriages in general are not immoral. It's something God had planned. We know that. We've seen that in the study. But that's the context that we're looking at as we go through these verses. Paul is not dealing with the issues that have come up out of these verses. He's dealing with something completely different. People have made issues out of these verses because, as Jesus told the Pharisees, because of the hardness of their hearts. One of the things that has become overwhelming as you look at commentaries and as you study through these verses is to see all the different positions that come up and how they're always based on a presupposition. Almost everybody that comes to these verses, if they already have their mind made up, can turn these verses into making them fit into their equation. What we have to do is see, what do the verses say? And then determine from that, how do they apply to situations that have come up, not the other way around. Because almost everyone who teaches a heresy on this has some kind of personal interest in it. It's the issue, really, with marriage, divorce, and remarriage. But these are the questions. Sexual relations, are they immoral? Not at all. They're natural, in the right context, they're perfect. Christian unbeliever marriages are not immoral. God has sanctioned those as well, and the hope is that one day maybe the unbeliever also can become a believer. First Peter talks about that. Other places mention that. And then marriages, of course, obviously are not immoral in general. God expects people to marry, so you can allow your daughter or son to marry. One of the things that we need to understand also as we look at this, one of the great arguments that's given when people want to dismiss the Apostle Paul, particularly because of the things that people find offensive in his writing, he is one of the most vehement as far as women's roles, as far as against homosexuality, against lots of things that people would like to see just kind of brushed under the table, and certainly marriage, divorce, and remarriage fits into that. They like to say, well, he's just a man writing from his chauvinistic perspective and the culture he was in. Absolutely not. They get that because once in a while he makes personal comments. But it's interesting what he does. Verse 10, for example, I command, well, yet not I, but the Lord. I'm telling you this is the way it is, but I'm telling you that because I'm an apostle of Jesus Christ. He is commanding you through me. His spirit that he gave to me is the one who's commanding you this. Look what he says in 1 Corinthians 2, for example. Paul, as he's going to write these things later, one of the things I love about 1 Corinthians, the Holy Spirit has just done an amazing work in this letter specifically, because he goes along setting up things that will come later in the letter. There are many times over when things will be said that seem kind of out of place almost in the introduction, that you'll see an exact point later how those things come back. And this is Paul setting up his apostolic authority. 1 Corinthians 2, verses 12 and following. We have received not the spirit of the world, but the spirit who is from God, that we might know the things that have been freely given to us by God. These things we also speak, not in words which man's wisdom teaches, but which the Holy Spirit teaches, comparing spiritual things with spiritual. And then, one of my favorites, right in a context that people love to throw out the window, 1 Corinthians 14, verse 37, he's just got done speaking about women being silent in the churches. He's talking about the role of submission. And he says, if anyone thinks himself to be a prophet or spiritual, and some of these women obviously did, let him acknowledge that the things which I write to you are the commandments of the Lord. So, the truly spiritual and truly prophetic person will bow down to the word of God. A true prophet is not going to say, I know more than God does, let me tell you what he meant to say. He's just going to say what God said. So Paul says, I command, but again, not me. This is the Lord who gives you this commandment. And then in verse 12 he says, to the rest, I, not the Lord, say, oh, well, there's the one that people like to jump on. See, he shifted gears. All of a sudden he's going to tell you the way he thinks it ought to be. At first he was talking about God, but now he's going to talk about himself. The point simply is that he's addressing issues that Jesus didn't specifically or personally treat. Jesus talked about marriage, and he talked about divorce. But in the context that Jesus was dealing with, there weren't even any Christians yet, much less Christians married to unbelievers. There were Jews, and he was talking about clarifying things the way he expected they would be in the kingdom. He told the apostles that all truth would be delivered to them through the Holy Spirit. That's what Paul's talking about here. He's not making things up. He's, again, revealing through the Holy Spirit things that Jesus didn't specifically talk about. One of the things that's interesting is that when Paul does give his opinion, he says, by the way, this is my opinion. Although I believe I have the Spirit of God, even if I've given you the opinion. Look at verses 6 and 7, for example, back in chapter 7 still, 1 Corinthians 7. He's talking about that they should come together so Satan doesn't tempt them for the lack of self-control. But I say this as a concession, this idea of not depriving one another except for a time with consent. I say this as a concession, not as a commandment. I'm not telling you separate yourselves. I'm saying if you feel like it's necessary, do it, but for only a short time. For I wish that all men, here's his opinion, verse 7, I wish that all men were even as I myself. But each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner, another in that. Well, obviously, that's his opinion. I wish you could all be like me. That's not a commandment of God. And then in verse 40, he does a similar thing, talking about the widow, would have a right to marry again if her husband died, but she is happier if she remains as she is, according to my judgment, and I think I also have the Spirit of God. I think I'm more capable of seeing the big picture than you guys are, because I know what the Spirit is telling me. And I'm not making a commandment that she remain alone, I'm just saying I think she'll be happier. It's my opinion. That's a pretty good opinion. It's an opinion based on what God has to say. It's not a command. But it's interesting that Paul lets us know when he's doing that. He didn't say anything about that in these verses. He's giving commands as an apostle. Now, the first thing he started out with was those things which you wrote about. In that original first part context there, he does take a sub-note and he says to the unmarried and to the widows some things. And it's really a question of propriety. They've got this question about whether or not it's immoral to be married and should we be able to marry again. It is good if they can continue unmarried, just as Paul is unmarried. Not that he is continuing unmarried in the sense that he was before, but he says, stay like I am. If you can do it, but it's better to marry than to burn with passion. There's a comparison. It's good if you can stay alone. It's better if you can't stay alone to go ahead and get married. There's nothing wrong with marriage, and that was his point there. And then he goes in the verses that are where the controversy comes up, and we'll probably spend the rest of our time here. I'd like to get to the other context as well, but Lord willing, we can do that next week. But here in verses 10 through 16, which you read before, he's in this section on to the married. And you'll notice that He just says to the married in general. He'll give some specifics later about who is who. But he's not saying to the married who are in a covenant relationship with God and who understand all the rules. No. This is anybody that's married anywhere. That's who he's talking about. And his command is really simple. All he's doing is restating God's law. It's amazing to me how often when we see these passages, they just hearken right back to Genesis 2. They hearken back to what Jesus had said in Matthew 19. A wife is not to depart from her husband. Well, it works both ways. A husband is not to divorce his wife. Those are the basic law in verses 10 and 11 because they're one flesh. From the beginning, they were made that way. Just for informational purposes, some people see that depart as just a separation. She's just going to walk away from the marriage. It's divorce. The word is very specific. Both of those words, depart and divorce, as they're translated in our, are to divorce in the Greek. She's not just walking away. She's cutting the relationship. She's severing the marriage with a divorce. Now, if it does happen that she departs, that's what verse 11 is dealing with, even though the bottom half says that it shouldn't happen. If it does happen, what do you do? Well, let her remain unmarried. And the reason is to avoid adultery, because adultery is she divorces for a reason that wasn't fornication and marries another. Whoever marries her is also in adultery, and if the one she divorced marries, then there's three cases of adultery going on, or at least three or four people involved in adultery. So let her remain unmarried. That's the concession. That is not the commandment, go out and just stay unmarried. No, this is, if this happens, then I concede, you stay like you are. Don't you mess it up worse. Or, there's the better choice. It is good if she remains unmarried. It is better if she's reconciled to her husband. Be reconciled. One thing that you'll notice about that is there's no other remarriage allowed for either person. This doesn't mention at all a second marriage for the one poor thing that was left behind as the one walked away. Now, I say that facetiously, poor thing that was left behind. It's a terrible situation when that happens. But what I mean is, people are demeaning the Word of God when they make these situations up and then they want to play on the heartstrings. We need to play on what God has told us to play with. It's His rules. And when we change them, we're demeaning Him. We're profaning His law. So there's no other remarriage allowed at all for either person. And that's really a bone of contention because this is the issue that will come up. And we'll see it in just a moment. So the command is simple. Don't divorce. If it happens, two options. Stay alone or go back to the one you walked away from. And then verse 12 comes along. And this is where people like to start making the playground change. They start liking to change the rules here. Because there's this "and to the rest." And this "to the rest" has been given so many different interpretations. It is a difficult and a vague phrase. It sounds specific enough, but "to the rest" is really general. And there are several possibilities. It could be that the rest he's speaking of here are the married who are a believer with an unbeliever, or the married who are both unbelievers. That's what some have taken this to be. It's just a blanket for everybody else that wasn't mentioned yet. The first two verses seem to be speaking explicitly of people who are believers. They know these rules and they're not going to break them. And so it's said then, although we're not told that in 10:11, it just seems to be speaking of believers. We're not told anything more than that. But verses 12 and following, then we're told by ones who want to defend this, this idea that there is remarriage allowed, we're told that it speaks to everybody else in the world that's not two Christians together. Well, it's a possibility. The phrase would allow for that. Except, there's nothing in here that addresses two unbelievers. If we're talking about everybody that wasn't mentioned yet, we're really only talking about an unbeliever with a believer. That's all that's mentioned here. We can't get from the text what they're trying to argue, which gets them into being able to say people are free later on. Maybe I'm overstating the issue here because we haven't got there yet. But there's nothing here addressing that. So this really can't be everybody else. Another possibility, though, and this one I think is much stronger. Instead of thinking of "as to the rest" as being the rest of the people that I haven't talked about yet, this phrase also can be saying "as to the rest of the situations that haven't been mentioned yet." As to the rest of the things that you asked me about, here's how you deal with those. it does seem implicitly here that there's this question of the believer with the unbeliever that he just all of a sudden begins to talk about. But he introduces it by saying, as to the rest. We say that. It's a strange translation, but the Greek holds that translation as this being the rest of the things very well. In our versions, it almost exclusively looks like to the rest of you people, and I think there's even some versions that do that, like American Standard says, as for the rest of you people. But that is not a definite translation. That is an interpretation. That's the point. Verses 10 and 11 talks about everybody. He just says to the married. The argument that's made by people who want to give relief, who want to say that not under bondage means you're free to marry, they have to find some way to start from the base back here, and they begin to say that verses 10 and 11 deal with believers only, and that the others, verses 12, 13, and 14, deal with a believer with an unbeliever, and there's nothing dealing with complete unbelievers. They're allowed to marry and remarry as much as they want. Then when they become believers, they got to stay where they are. That's really convenient when you're teaching somebody who's been married five times, but it's not what the Bible teaches. I would not be comfortable telling someone, you're fine, stay in that situation, because now that you're Christians, you know the difference. This section doesn't mention that at all. That's a presumed distinction. And so that's why I'm wanting to look and see what does this, the rest, mean. It very possibly and very probably means the rest of the situations that could arise. That's a good possibility. And the support for that, I think, is stronger. Look at verse 15. As he's concluding his thoughts on this section, he says, in such cases, a brother or sister is not under bondage. What such cases? Well, the rest of the cases that you were asking about, this type of situation. It seems to support the interpretation that we're talking about cases or situations. Now, I know cases is put in there in italics. It's there by interpolation. It's something that the Greek has inside the word such there that's not involved necessarily in the English, so they had to clarify it. But the idea is there in the Greek, supporting this thought that this is talking about the rest of the situation. Those are the two major possibilities. There are lots of other things that have come up. At any rate, the rest could be speaking along that way. Whatever the case is, there is a case that's in question here, and we need to look at that. It's a believer who's married to an unbeliever, and that's really what we're dealing with in verses 12 through 16. Because they had questions about that now. Especially those who may have had a Jewish background. Remember how Corinth began? The church in Corinth in Acts chapter 18, they began at the synagogue as usual. Then they were kicked out of the synagogue, but soon we see Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue, he's converted. He's beaten even by the Jews at one point. It's a mess, but it began with Jews. And maybe the Judaizing teachers had made it as far as Corinth. We know they'd been to Galatia already by this point. So it could be that he's dealing with people who are having these Jewish kind of questions. Can we be married to a pagan? The Jews, they couldn't. That was certainly against God's law. So here's the command. If you're married to an unbeliever, do not divorce. It's interesting that these verses are a parallel to 10 and 11. When you look at the structure of them, they're exactly parallel to 10 and 11. First you have the don't divorce. Same command that was given to the believers, if you want to say two believers. The believer never can depart. And in fact, it seems to be a comfort issue here. No, you don't need to seek a divorce. You know that God hates divorce. Why would you think he'd want you to seek a divorce from the pagan? Well, maybe they're looking at Nehemiah and Ezra when they made them divorce their pagan wives. It's possible. But he's saying, no, you don't need to do that. You don't need to seek that divorce. Do not divorce, in fact. And then in verse 14, he makes it clear. This is not defilement as it would have been with the Jews. You're sanctified. That word doesn't mean saved, by the way, although the saints are sanctified in Jesus Christ. These are people who are sanctified by their marriage relationship. The covenant that they have with that married person makes them useful in the marriage relationship. The word sanctified means set apart for a certain use. That's the idea here. They're set apart for the use of the husband or the wife, but it's not something that's defiled or profane. It's not the same as it would have been in Judaism. So, then the other question comes up. What do you do, though, if the one who doesn't believe, the one who's not interested in suffering for the faith of Christ, remember also this present distress that Paul's talking about, how hard would it be if your husband or wife was converted, you knew that the authorities could come and kill them because of this conversion of theirs, you knew they were doing things that everybody thought was strange, that they wanted you to be involved with, but you didn't want anything to do with it. How hard would it be to maintain a relationship like that? I don't know how many of you may have been the only one converted for a long time before your husband or wife was. I know people that are for years in that situation. It's tough. It's terrible. But think about it when it could involve your life. You could be killed for your association with a Christian, and you don't even want to be a part of that. Think about how hard it might be for someone who didn't believe, and they might just say, well, I'm leaving. I don't want to put up this, especially if it means death for me or my family. So what do you do if the unbeliever does depart? Well, let him depart. Isn't that strange? Verse 15, if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. Now, the issue is, this is not the believer initiating a divorce, initiating a separation. If the other wants to go, well, what are you going to do? They don't believe in God's law. You can't shackle them to the door frame. You can't make them stay. Let them depart. You've done what you can do. Let them depart. Now, we need to understand, again, this is not a command. Make them depart. No, this is an allowance. If that's what they want, you're not going to force them to stay. It's a concession if it occurs. There are some other verses that are kind of interesting that deal with this phraseology, let it happen. 1 Corinthians 14, verse 38, if anyone is ignorant, let him be ignorant. He doesn't say command him to be ignorant. Allow it to happen. If that person doesn't want to learn any better, let them stay like they are. You move on. You do better. And in Revelation 22, that's some strong language there, but it's got the same kind of construction. Just so we get this point. Revelation 22, verse 11, he who is unjust, let him be unjust still. He who is filthy, let him be filthy still. He who is righteous, let him be righteous still. He who is holy, let him be holy still. It's a beautiful picture of this idea that people's nature won't change in the afterlife. That's why hell is hell and heaven is heaven. It's going to be just full of people that wanted to be there. They did everything they could to get there. Or they weren't interested in not going and keeping out of there. At any rate, their nature is what puts them there. Their nature is going to stay. That's the idea here, too. You can't change this situation. So if it's going to happen, then you just allow it to happen. It's not that you wanted it to happen. It's not that you sought for it to happen. But you don't have to hold on. Now here's where it gets into our controversy. A brother or a sister, obviously a believer, the one who didn't walk away from the marriage, is not under bondage in such cases. This is the million-dollar question. What in the world is that? Does it mean then, if God is saying you can let them go, then he is then liberating me to marry someone who is of the same faith so that I can then carry on with my happy life? Is that what he's saying? That's the argument. Sounds great. No longer bound by law. I'm not under bondage. However, it only makes sense in English. Now, I'm not an advocate of saying you have to know the original language to understand the Bible. But there are some passages where when you can see what the original was, it makes so much sense. A Greek reader would never read that and think, great, I'm free to marry again. A Greek reader would understand by the very word used exactly what's meant there. Two different Greek words are used there. And it's interesting that they even, depending on which Greek lexicon you read, they may come from the same root. There are two possibilities of even the root they come from. I read a really great defense of this idea that they came from the same root, therefore they mean the same thing, actually a defense against it. What most people will say is since dio, which is bound, and dolu, or whatever, is bondage, since they come from the same root, which is dio itself, that they mean the same thing, and so they're interchangeable. Well, the word nice in English comes from the Latin word necius, and my wife probably knows what that word means because it's almost exactly like the Portuguese word necius, which means foolish. You're nice because you're foolish, or that's how this connotation came about. But our English word nice comes through that word necius, ignorant or foolish. And they don't mean the same thing, certainly. The root doesn't necessarily bring you to an understanding of exactly what the contemporary word means. You have to see it in the context. So what do these words mean in their biblical context? We've done that with adultery and some of the other words. Let's look at these to make sure that we're not making this mistake. Bondage versus bound. Well, bondage, obviously, there is a noun. It's a noun that's the result of being made a slave of, this dolo. It could be you are reduced to bondage. Metaphorically, it's if you give yourself wholly to one's needs and service. That's an interesting definition because of the way it plays into the context we're looking at here. giving yourself wholly to one's needs and service, making yourself a bondsman to that person. And then you get dio, which is bound, to bind, to tie, to fasten with chains or throw into chains. Metaphorically, Satan bound a woman. We saw when Jesus met this woman who was doubled over and Satan had bound her, he said. A demon had taken possession of her and caused her to be doubled over. She was bound. To put under obligation, you're bound by the law. This is what our marriage binding looks like. In fact, the sub point there is just exactly that. You're bound under obligation of law, under obligation of duty. Who made the marriage laws? The one who bound them. Be bound to one, a wife or husband. And then it's got this interesting. To forbid, prohibit, declare to be illicit. You're bound from doing something, is the idea. So you've got these two verbs that are quite different. This one is to fasten together, and this one is to be made a slave of, or to be given wholly to. Now, back down here. This word bondage, doulou, never, ever in the New Testament and anywhere else as far as I know, refers to a marriage bond. It is never used in that sense, ever. If it were, this is the only verse in the whole Bible where it would be used that way. That's the argument, though. Based on this verse, the argument is that that word means the same thing as bound, this word bondage. Bound, deo, is always used when we're talking about the marriage bond. And the word specifically bond is found 1 Corinthians 7, verse 27. Later on, he'll say, are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be loosed. Are you loosed from a wife? Do not seek a wife. That word bound, again, all of a sudden is this bound word, deo. And then in verse 39, when he says a wife is bound by law as long as her husband lives, the same thing that he says in Romans 7, the woman is bound by the law to her husband, it's always that same word, dio. Why is that important? Well, both the grammar, something we didn't get into here, but the tenses of these words prove that the person has never even been in that situation. So a person that is married and then is not under bondage, they're not talking about the same bond, because under marriage they were in a situation of being bound. Now they're saying you're not bound. Well, this is a different kind of bound. And the grammar won't allow it. The definitions of the word, they prohibit that this phrase means no longer bound by law to the husband. Absolutely prohibitive. And that's, like I said, a Greek reader would pick this up and read it and would never get that idea that people have come up with from the hardness of their hearts. They could see those words and would know. They wouldn't even think of the issue that we're dealing with. Now, what does it mean? If it doesn't mean that the marriage bond has been severed, well, what does it mean? And there's a variety of possibilities there. It could mean, from the context, you look at verses 10 through 13, where don't leave, don't depart. The believer is told over and again, you cannot leave the marriage. But then the one leaves, the other one leaves. Do you have to chase them? Do you have to stay after them so that the marriage will remain? Well, no. Possibly this means you're not bound to stay with that mate who doesn't want you there. That's a very firm possibility. Another one, because of the usage of being bound in sin in Romans chapter 6, it's possible, same author in terms of the Holy Spirit, in terms of the apostle, you're not slaves in sin if you allow the one to depart. They know they shouldn't be divorcing, but the one went away, and now Paul's saying, don't stop him. Well, God's allowing for this. They want to depart. You didn't initiate it. You tried to stop it, and then they went anyway. You're not in sin because of that. That's a possibility. But here's the one I think is the strongest, and there are still others out there. I think from this general context of these questions on sexual morality that are being given, that there's no bondage here to this prior injunction of rendering the affection that's due. Because that was the focal point of the first part. As Paul said, there is nothing wrong with sexuality. There, in fact, is a need for it within a certain context, that when that context is broken, you don't have to go after that person to render the affection that's due. Because he was kind of hard on them in the first couple of verses there. He said, you must, in fact, give your body to the other one. It is their authority over your body. But here he's saying you're no longer enslaved to that. You're no longer bound to that particular obligation, if you will. But not under bondage, what's interesting about it is that it's really in contrast there in verse 15 with, but we are called to peace. God has called us to peace. The believer is not enslaved to fulfilling his due at the cost of forcing himself on an unwilling mate. You're not forced to go dragging across the country after this person. Now, something that's interesting, I know very well a preacher whose wife left him for another man. And he took a vow of celibacy. And it's been more than 10 years now. He recently wrote about this vow and how it's changed his life and how it's made him look at things differently and how he's kept it. He moved all the way across the country to where she went to be with her new husband, this guy she married, so he would be there if she decided to repent and come back. He lost almost everything he had to be able to do this and to follow her around. Now, he knew he wasn't under bondage to her to do that, but it was his desire to grant her every opportunity for repentance and to come back. And finally, after almost 10 years, he saw that she wasn't going to change her mind, and he's come back to this side of the country, where he continues to raise their children by himself. But that's the idea here, that he wasn't duty-bound to do that. He did that on his own honor. He did that for a vow he made to God, and that he was quick to hold. I thought I would throw that in there as an example, because these things do happen. And his wife was a believer and walked away. She threw away her belief as well, her faith as well. The point in all this, because of the arguments that are made, we need to understand, there is never, in the middle of all this, there's never an allowance for contracting a new marriage. What is said is that since they're not under bondage, then God is allowing a new marriage, but he never mentions that. That's not even part of the issue. But that's put in here, piggybacking on bad Greek, bad interpretation. In fact, what would be true, since these are parallel passages anyway, is that the law there of verse 11 would still apply. The only thing that even the unbeliever could do when they left would be to remain unmarried or to reconcile, because otherwise adultery is going to be the result. Anything else is presumption, and it leads to adultery. It's a pretty strong text. And it's amazing that Paul acknowledges even the noble motive for following the mate. Look at verse 16, and I think this was really what the preacher I know had in mind. How do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? I think most people see that in a positive light. I never have been able to do that. It looks like a negative question to me. Why chase him down? You don't even know that it's going to do any good. You're not bound to do that. You've done what you can do. Now, I think it's noble for those who want to do it. And Paul's saying that. But there are no guarantees, and certainly there's no command to follow them. They're not under bondage to do that. That is what, from the context, seems to be the clearest teaching on that particular question. Again, the specific context involves those various issues. We saw things you wrote, we saw to the unmarried, and we saw to the married. The next one that we would look at is remain as God has called you, but we're already over time for tonight. I appreciate your patience, and think about this issue very deeply for next week. We'll finish up this bit in the chapter here, and we'll look at some other issues that go along with this. We've got some questions pending still, I'm aware of, and Lord willing, we'll get to those next week.